Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome back to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa and today I'm joined by Heather, Pat, Linda, Stephanie and Nicola.
Hello!
Hello!
Hi.
This week we're talking about independent publishing houses. We interview Kate McDonald from Handheld Press, a small publishing house that's causing quite a stir. Heather will be sharing a poem in progress with us. We discuss our writing lives and Pat and Craig Smith will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. Stephanie is going to be talking about some words that are easily confused. But before that, I just want to say a special hello to our listeners in Botswana.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I did say Botswana. Stephanie recently did some statistical analysis of our listeners, and we were really surprised and delighted to discover that we have a friend in Botswana. If it's you, do introduce yourself on our Facebook group. We'd love to know more about you. But now, over to Linda, who's going to ask us to
name the novel.
I don't think this is going to stump anyone today. So, have you got pencils ready?
Yep.
One? Okay. Published in 1981 by Alfred Knopf, this novel centers on a wealthy white couple living on a Caribbean island with their black servant couple, and the servant couple's black, Sorbonne-educated, beautiful, and sophisticated niece.
Like looks all round.
Well, you know, that was a very generous clue, I thought.
Oh, yes.
Well, it sounds like as if it would be if you knew the novel.
Wow.
Okay, number two. A black man of radically different background washes up on their estate. He is impoverished, strong-willed, rough kind of man. Despite their differences, he and the niece fall in love.
No idea.
No, absolutely not.
No, absolutely. You guys really should. Oh.
Read more?
Jadine and Sun travel back to the States to find a place where they can both feel at home. Their struggle reveals the problems faced by black Americans who seek to live and love with integrity in the United States.
I have no idea.
Doesn't ring any bells.
I know
you're all familiar with this author. Surely. No, it's Tar Baby by Toni Morrison.
Well, I know Toni Morrison. Yeah.
I haven't read that one.
I haven't either.
No, it sounds really good, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it does. Yeah. Definitely, definitely.
So, they're on the list.
Nothing else is going on my list.
No.
Well, you've got us, every one of us. Well, yes. Thanks, Linda. Well done. Now it's over to Heather for her work in progress.
Okay. Waiting, waiting, forever waiting. The tension in the airport lounge visible. Anxious faces creased with concern. Checking watches, passes and screens. Coffee machines bubbling and steaming, the low murmur of voices constantly humming, the occasional child screaming or shouting, people pretending not to see or to care. The unmistakable aroma of people and food, freshly cooked onions and something too sweet, masking the smell of the unwashed and scared, the undertones of the not-so-subtle airport air. The sticky tables not quite dry, the crunch underfoot of crisps and crumbs, hands itching to be washed but never feel clean, the need for fresh air to blow the staleness away. Food ordered and served with no hint of a smile, the taste and texture of the meal not quite right, the fruit past its best, the bread going hard, more left on the plate than can ever be eaten. The time's drawing near to board the plane, more checking of watches, passes and screens, everyone wanting to be first in the queue, rushing and pushing to get home to you.
Heather's been in quite a few airports.
Yes.
Lately in airports. So.
Yes.
Did Did you compose that in
the I did, yes.
I thought it was brilliant to attempt a poem. I mean, wow, that's so cool.
There's some great observations about things you see in an airport. Yeah.
It's like a series of snapshots.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Nice. Yes.
I did feel as though I'd been there forever.
Yeah. Getting desperate if you're writing poems. Yeah.
So well, Heather started us when she joined us. She started with poetry.
Yeah, she did, yeah. I think in the final line you do achieve a real poignancy because that's what it's about. And I know you were going to your daughter and you say it felt like a long time. I once spent 2 nights in an airport with flights cancelled and different things happened and I was trying to get to my daughter's wedding. Luckily we set out on the Wednesday. Yeah. And on Friday morning at about 5 a.m. my husband said, I think I've got us a flight that will get us there. So, you know, we got to the destination in Scotland eventually on the Friday night before the wedding on the Saturday. So I can really identify with that. And that's what it's all about, isn't it? It's not the journey and the situation. It's about getting to that person who needs you or that you want to be with. So I thought that, you know, was really poignant at the end.
And you summed up wonderfully the underlying layer of tension that everybody feels because you are constantly checking the boards and your watch to make sure nothing's changed. Yes. And you can't.
It's
quite
never
ever
really
relax.
Relaxing, is it? No. Even in the best of airports.
Yeah. And I struggled a little bit with the number of beats in each line, but I noticed when you read it, you changed the number of beats in some of the lines from the copy that I've got here. And I'd actually made a note to myself that I was finding it hard to get the beat, and I'd said, "Wait and hear how Heather reads it."
Apart from odd lines, I didn't find that. I've made a note that I thought there was a good rhythm and structure to it, and it was just odd.
Might be the northern accent.
you don't always want a completely regular rhythm, because that can be a bit soporific or whatever. Or, you know, so it depends what you're trying to achieve.
Tum-ti-tum-ti-tum,
I like tum-ti-tum-ti-tum, you see. That's me. That's the kind of thing I like.
I find that comforting.
So do I.
I had just a couple of points that I picked up on. I wasn't totally happy about the occasional child. The occasional child screaming or shouting. I thought maybe occasionally a child.
The occasional scream.
The occasional child sounded. And more left on the plate than could ever be eaten.
Oh,
you're talking about the food. I don't know, it didn't make a lot of sense to me, so it jarred.
Pat doesn't leave things on
the Well, yeah.
I wondered about the syntax on hands itching to be washed but never feel clean.
It should be feeling.
Feeling clean.
Yeah. But no, I liked it.
Well, I could picture you sitting there in the airport, being at the gate already and waiting and observing.
And making the notes. That's what it felt like to me.
Right. Yes.
Great. Well, thank you, Heather. Now, Stephanie, what have you got for us today?
Well, I was thinking about being enraged and being outraged, and I thought, are they different or are they the same? Because they can be interchangeable in some contexts, because in terms of a verb, they mean something very similar. So to enrage means to cause feelings of anger or to displease or to make furious. And to outrage is something quite similar, because it's to cause someone to feel angry, shocked or upset or to scandalise. So they're actually very close. Outrage is also a noun. Mm-hmm. So outrage is a feeling of anger or shock. So you can have an outrage being a morally unacceptable or violent act would be an outrage. So that's really a difference there. But I was then wondering, you know, enrage is E-N-R-A-G-E and outrage is O-U-T. I was wondering, is it enrage? An outrage, and have we just, you know, because with old English, have we changed it? So I thought, maybe they're linked, enrage and outrage. So I was just curious. So I looked at the etymology. Okay, so here's what it is. The word rage comes from the Latin rabies.
Ooh.
That was curious, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And enrage is from the old French, enragia. My French isn't very good, but it means to go wild or to go mad or to lose one's senses. And that's from en, E-N, put in or make, and rage or rabies. Yeah. So that's where it came from. It came from the French. And then in French, outre is beyond. And yeah. Beyond was fused with rage, thus making Outrage.
Yeah.
And we first saw that in English in 1300s.
Really?
So Enrage and Outrage actually both come from the French, and they've kind of come through from the English.
But with the Normans.
Yes, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So I'm only guessing here, and Pat will have to correct me, but I reckon an outrageous act could enrage me, but I can be outraged too, but there's no such thing as an enrageous act.
Oh,
I would concur.
Good. To the best of my knowledge.
But yeah. I think something you said quite close to the beginning, outrage is more scandalised when you're outraged rather than just angry.
Yeah. I would say so. Yeah. It tends to be.
Well, that would be the beyond rage.
Outre.
Outre, yeah.
Mm. Kind of means that, doesn't it? It's very out there.
Anyway, I thought I'd share that with you as a pointless but interesting set of facts about words.
Yeah, thanks very much, Stephanie. Okay, it's time now to find out who's made progress and who's been procrastinating, as we have our regular chat about our writing lives. Now, I can see that people are crawling under the table as I speak. But, Nicola, you have been plotting and writing like a demon recently.
I have, yes. A synchronicity strikes when a series of circumstances happen, and something triggered me to go and look for a science fiction editor, because I picked up somewhere that you can work with an editor as you're writing, and I was feeling particularly stuck that day. So I went and found a science fiction editor called Sean Coyne. He'd worked with some really great people, and then as I was investigating him, I found that he worked a lot with Stephen Pressfield, who is a guy who writes historical fiction, but great historical fiction. And then I realised that Stephen Pressfield is the man who wrote The War of Art, which is all about procrastination and resistance and all that stuff. So I'm starting to get very interested now. And I went and found out they had a publishing company together, independent publishing company called Black Irish Books. And then I found out that he had a book called The Story Grid. And I went through that like a dose of salts, and I really loved it, because what it did was it made the whole nebulous thing of writing a book a lot more concrete for me, because it set out a structure on how to do it. Now, I know I've talked about the snowflake method before, but this takes it to a whole other level. But the thing I love most about it is that it's talking about structure of great stories, and it's not excluding literary works, and it's not excluding non-fiction even, because Stephen Pressfield used this story grid method to write his War of Art. So it's good for non-fiction, it's good for fiction, literary fiction, but it's always about becoming a better writer, so I thought you guys would like it too. So what it did for me was it gave me a way of melding together all the things I've heard about, like the hero's journey and the three-act structure, and it gave me a structure to hang my little story on. What I was finding out about now was like genre, because it goes so much deeper than just where do you put your book on Amazon. And each genre has its own overarching story theme. You start to get deeper into your own story, and you start to really realise, you know, what you're trying to say. So it shows you how to. There's videos on YouTube. Check them out. There's 5 videos. They're fantastic. But the book's great. And what it does is it gives you a sort of structure for your whole book. And I slotted in the scenes I've already written. And it makes you realise, well, A, how much more you've got to write.
Yeah.
But it gives you ideas about the conventions of your genre and your required scenes. So each genre has a certain number of required scenes. And your readers feel disappointed if you don't cover them. But the trick in great writing, before everyone goes, oh, well, it's up to creativity. Not that you lot would do that. But the trick is to twist the required scenes in an unusual way. But better than that, he's got a podcast called Story Grid, and he takes a guy who's been in marketing in the book world, who wants to write a book, literally from the day I want to write a book, and he takes it right through to publishing his book. Mm. And it's something like 200 episodes. It's very, very in-depth. And he gets him to the first draft quite quickly, within half a year. And you know, for anyone who's been struggling with their books, not looking anywhere in particular for a long time, I think this could be incredibly helpful. And for a new writer, it's like a university course. I'm doing like a deep dive immersion on it. But what it's doing more than anything is it's inspiring me.
Right. So where has it taken you with your writing?
Yeah. Okay. So I've got my whole book planned out now. I thought I was writing a science fiction book. I'm writing an action thriller.
Okay.
And the best thing is I kept having this nagging feeling. Oh, no, if I was a science fiction fan, which I am, and I picked this book up, I'd be disappointed because it's not very science fiction-y.
Right.
But actually what I'm doing is I'm writing an action thriller with supernatural twists. And it tells me the scenes I need to write. It tells me the overarching theme I need to have. And so I've been able to go and plot out all the scenes I need to write now.
And I know some people are very resistant to anything that seems to give a structure or to tend towards making your writing more formulaic. But actually understanding the conventions, for example, in the theatre, the convention is when the lights go down, the audience then goes quiet, and that we pretend that what we see on stage is real. And, you know, you have to engage in those conventions to a certain extent, and you can break them and you can change them. But what this doesn't do, it doesn't tell you how to write. It doesn't make you a better or worse writer, but it gives you some structure. And what we watched some of the videos together, and one of the things I realised, which was a bit of a breakthrough for me, was I need a villain. Not some nebulous kind of bad guys in the background, but Ronella actually needs to confront an individual who is a villain. And at a later stage, she needs to be at the mercy of the villain. And that just makes the story more stronger, more exciting, more interesting for the reader.
Yeah.
And without doing the whole kind of story grid thing, I kind of glean that.
Well, the point is that you're right. It doesn't make you a better writer. I mean, what he's coming from a place of assuming that everyone's got an idea for a story and everyone can string a sentence together. It's great for people like Steph, who's written a book and she can now edit it herself.
Yeah.
It's or you could start from the beginning before you've even written a word. I find it very inspiring.
Brilliant.
Well, you convinced me to listen in, and there are 5 bits on YouTube, and I've watched all of those, and I bought the book, and I found I had the middle written. Previously, it was a short story, and now I realize it's really going to be the all is lost moment, which a very important discovery for me.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is procrastination rears its ugly head again. And Nicola told us about a new way she'd found to procrastinate at one point. And it's all about fiddling around with the layout. And I found in the past week, I was up sometimes till 3 in the morning, 4:30 in the morning, because I started fiddling around with layout. I went back to all my chapters and
you bad, bad girl.
I did. I went back to them and I made sure all the margins were the same.
Oh, yes.
Oh, goodness sake.
I've got one chapter that just won't be uncentered. It's
just ignore it.
Don't worry about that.
So, Pat?
Well, I've been inspired by Nicola to a limited extent, I must admit. But also, I don't know whether it's that or whether it's just sort of coincidental, but I've managed to sort of get another short story out and finished.
Good.
Not necessarily completely edited, but at least the bones of it. I've got another one. Well, it's a revisit to an earlier one that I'm thinking, I think I might see a way through with that one. But also bubbling in the background, I've got an idea for a novel. But I haven't as yet. I'm the sort of person that I have to put things down on paper and I have to actually jot down ideas. So I need to do that and see if there's enough material, if there's enough mileage. I always start with just like a character and a situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't have this, and this will happen and this will happen it will all end.
This is what I'm learning to do, is to plot it out. And it is making a big difference.
Yeah.
Whether you use cards or a spreadsheet or a notebook, but try, you know, if you use the 3-act structure or the hero's journey or the story grid, try to plot it out and see where it's going. And that's really helped me. And the plot is evolving as I write.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a rigid thing that I have to stick to, but it means that I can't say, I don't know what to write next.
Mm-hmm.
I know what I need to write. Yeah. I know what the next scene is. Mm-hmm. And I've just got to get my bum in the chair and write it.
That's a phrase that crops up again and again and again, isn't it? When you interviews and you have to get the bum in the chair.
You have to show up.
Yep.
Right. Heather, I know you've been nursing your daughter.
I've not done very much at all from sitting in airports. I have started to try and get together part 2 of the journey, where I printed the first part. I've learnt a lot from that, and I've learnt a lot from comments that people made, and I'm trying to do, part 2. Problem is, it's likely to be quite boring, because how many times can you say, you know, I live in the sunshine, or, you know, I live in Buxton in the snow, and every day is very much the same. It's not like doing a journey.
No, you have to look for the narratives within that.
Yeah, so I'm kind of struggling a bit to get, and a bit we've all talked about, I keep playing with the layout and, you know, the story. And,
this is a terrible new thing you've introduced, Nicola, playing
Well, at least you're all cleaning your light switches, which is where I go when I'm really desperate.
Yeah, so I've got to get back now to the day, you know, making the day, and I start early in the morning, mm-hmm. sit down, bum in the chair, sit down and do it.
Just get What's back happening to your street of people?
I'm still working on the domestic violence story, mm-hmm. but again, it's there's lots of bits of things going on, and I just need to get myself focused mm-hmm. and get one thing done.
Stephanie?
Well, as you know, beginning of the month, beginning of February, I went on a weekend intensive course with Faber, which was an online retreat. And it was utterly exhausting, but really, really, really good. And that's left me with so much stuff to go at. Basically, it started on a Friday evening with podcasts and videos. And there were transcripts of the podcasts and videos, because sometimes you listen to a podcast or watch a video and you kind of drift off. Yeah. So it's quite useful to have the transcript and not having to keep re-listening to it. And the weekend was split into influences, ideas, openings, endings and editing. Lots and lots and lots of reading of short stories and listening to short story writers, very successful short story writers, talking about the way that they go about it. And the reading was it was a lot of Raymond Carver and Rose Tremain.
You don't mean you had to read the whole book?
No, you read, it was short stories. Okay. You read the short stories. There was directed reading of texts and then writing notes about what you'd learnt from this text, which does sound a little bit studious, but it was just illuminating. It was fabulous. I thoroughly enjoyed it. As I say, I was exhausted. One little touch that I really liked was on the Saturday night. Obviously, if you're at a retreat and you're all together, you'd go off and have a glass of wine on a Saturday night, wouldn't you? But of course, we're all in our own homes. We're online. So the Saturday evening exercise, they gave us four short stories, each of which had been made into a movie. And they said, right, you can, you know, read these four short stories and then choose one to watch the movie of, which are all available on Netflix and Amazon Prime and so on. So I thought that was a really, really great touch, because you kind of get to Saturday evening and you're exhausted and they're like, no, we're not letting you off the hook. Now you're going to watch a movie with your glass of wine. But there were some great people on there, some really interesting work. There were a couple of people from the States, people from the Netherlands that are writing in English, mm-hmm. which is not their first language. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's humbling. Their command of a language that isn't even mm-hmm. their first language. Mm-hmm. It was really, really good. And, you know, for me, who couldn't get down to London or to, you know, up to Yorkshire to do a retreat, it was so nice to be able to do it in my own home, get out and walk the dog, take my husband a cup of tea and so on, mm-hmm. and not have to leave the comfort of my own home. So it's great. So I'd recommend it to anybody as an option.
Well, obviously,
I really enjoyed
it's been
it.
Really stimulating.
Yes, it has.
In terms of, because I think the idea behind the course was either to write a short story in a weekend or stress test an idea for a novel.
Yes.
And I know that you were kind of open to both of those.
Yes,
so
was,
where did it take
right,
you?
Right, well, I've got about four short stories in progress.
Wow.
A lot of it was 15-minute exercises. That's really daunting. You get 15 minutes and then you have to post what you've done in 15 minutes.
The
temptation to cheat and go back and edit it and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And at first, lots of us were saying, I have to confess, I did edit this a bit before I posted it. Or actually, I spent 20 minutes on this, not 15. But once we all started to trust each other, by Saturday lunchtime, we were throwing stuff up there that had just been. But, you know, some of the ideas that came out, that's created several short story ideas. And yes, one of the short story ideas is actually about one of the characters in my thing, but it's written from the point of view of her son. I might share it with you sometime.
Uh-huh.
But, it's just a lot of fun. A lot of fun, as I say, exhausting, mm-hmm. not for the faint-hearted. Mm-hmm. And if you don't like studying texts, you know, if you're not somebody mm-hmm. that wants to do the sort of cerebral part of mm-hmm. writing and reading like a writer, then probably not for you. But for me, it was just incredible. Loved it.
Stephanie, do they run this very often? Was it a one-time only?
No, they run it quite regularly. I don't know when the next one is, but, you know, it's run quite regularly.
So if any of us and our listeners would like to do it, you can watch out where?
Yeah, on the Faber Academy website. Yeah,
sounds wonderful.
Yeah, no, it was. It was good. I enjoyed it. And Tom Bromley, we've met him before. Mm-hmm. He talked to us about editing and so on. He's a great tutor. It's great fun. And there's live web chats throughout the programme as well, so you all meet up online and go, oh God, you know, it's killing me and so on. It's good. It's a great idea.
I liked it. Well, I have finished a first draft of my one act play.
I just heard Teresa say the word I've finished.
Yeah. Yeah. A first draft.
Which is brilliant.
And it's quite short. A local Amdram group have agreed to read it and critique it for me, so that'll be good, because I think I know the good bits and the bad bits. I know where the holes are, but it'd be useful to get from an acting perspective where they think the holes are. And I've just been ploughing on with Ranella, as I mentioned earlier. I've worked quite a lot on the plotting. I've got about 6 chapters plus half of chapter 11, which started out as chapter 5, but as I've plotted, it's got pushed back and back, and I realise it comes much later, that scene.
You're on a roll.
Well, for me, that's quite productive, I would say.
Yeah.
So,
I love the story.
Good.
Ranella the Goat Girl.
Yeah. When I get to a certain point, I am going to put all these chapters together. It'll be maybe a third or a half of the book, and then, because I know you like to read things up in sequence. And then I might be looking for some 10-year-old beta readers as well. And I have plenty of great nephews and nieces.
I've got some beta readers, 10-year-old beta readers.
So that's what I'd like to do with that. But that's a little further down the road later in the year. Yeah. I'll be doing that.
Fabulous.
So Stephanie and I have been exploring the independent press, small presses. According to Wikipedia, independent publisher, small press, indie publisher, all interchangeable names for the same sort of thing. And they suggest that in the US, it refers to a publisher with annual sales below $50 million, which doesn't sound that small to me. However, we define the independent press as publishers that are not part of large conglomerates or multinational corporations. And believe it or not, they make up approximately half the market.
Wow.
So not to be ignored as potential publishers. Many small presses go in for specialisation, such as genre fiction, poetry, limited edition books, and sometimes non-fiction as well. There is some confusion between indie publishers and what's not very politely called vanity publishing. But the difference is this, and when I was looking up independent publishers, some came up calling themselves independent publishers, but it was basically pay me and I'll print your book. So the difference is that an independent publisher wouldn't ask you to pay. They will have some quality control. They will choose manuscripts and they will provide editing and marketing services. So that's the difference there. One important thing about small presses is they tend to fill the niches that larger publishers neglect. They can focus on regional titles. They can have narrow specializations and niche genres. What they lack in commercial clout, they can make up for by getting a reputation, say, for academic knowledge or for winning prizes, finding new authors. The Irish Times recently published an article, 50 Books to Keep You Reading All Year Long. And what they did is they went to 25 small publishers and asked them to recommend 2 of their books. And the reason that they give for singling out the small publishers is because they suggest that mainstream publishers are very risk-averse at the moment. They're looking for surefire bestsellers, and they're not interested. In the old days, they might have a bestseller which would support less popular books in their portfolio, but that isn't happening. And they quote Kevin Duffy of Blue Moose Books, "It is the independents who are doing most of the heavy lifting in finding the new writers and voices that resonate and engage the reader." So Dublin-based Stinging Fly Press was the first to bring out books by Kevin Barry, Mary Costello and Colin Barrett. Galley Beggar Press, a British independent, was behind 2 recent winners of the Desmond Elliott Prize for debut novels. last year's We That Are Young by Pretty Teenager, and in 2014, Emma McBride's A Girl brilliant. Is a Half-Formed Thing.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant.
Okay. The Lilliput Press sees the role of the Independents as discovering those who have something important to contribute to Irish life, to celebrate individual voices and to give a home to work that other more commercial houses may overlook.
Many, many of the small presses that I know of do not require an agent.
That's interesting.
They have their own submission process and you can submit directly. But of course, then you're negotiating your own financial package, you're negotiating your own contract. Right. You know, if there are rights for television, radio, etc., you know, you're going to be... But I would imagine once you have a publisher, it would be much easier to get an agent.
I would think that most of them will have a standard contract anyway, if they're established. So, yeah, I mean, I picked out some of the books from the Irish Times list, which looked really interesting. I won't go through them all, but one that caught my eye for obvious reasons was from Open Press, The Complete Guide to the Best Pubs and Bars in Dublin, Martin, which came out in February. So that one I'll be looking for. A Proper Person to be Detained, which will be published by Saraband Contraband in July, by Catherine Czerkowska, I think, is a genre-defying book telling the tragic story of the murder of one of the author's Irish immigrant ancestors in 1880s Leeds. But it's so much more than a straightforward true crime book. Her quest for the facts uncovers the truth behind family secrets and reveals what life was really like for some of society's most marginalised groups, Irish immigrants, women and the working class. So that sounds fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to that.
That's good.
Nicola?
Yes, I found two interesting publishers and one book that I've got to read. Legend Press, this caught my eye because these guys are the most successful independent publishers to start up without capital in the last 30 years. After starting in 2005, they've become one of the fastest growth publishing houses in the country, shortlisted for Independent Publisher of the Year. Managing Director Tom Chalmers has only 25 years old. He is just incredible what they've achieved. That's nice to hear that someone's doing well, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then I came across Cillian Press, which is all about embracing the changing technologies in publishing and have released their works for multiple e-book readers around the world. Based in Manchester, they specialise in fiction, contemporary, young adult and adult novels, committed to giving every publication the best chance of success and developing long-lasting relationships with authors.
Mm-hmm.
And I was skimming through their list for this year and I came across a book called Word on the Street, a darkly comic reflection on homelessness, life writing and dermatology. So the papers call it tramp flu, but the doctors don't know what to call it. Homeless people are dying and the government are scrambling for an answer. Suddenly the public is no longer immune. A pretty little schoolgirl is in hospital. And I thought that sounded like a
that
really
sounds great, doesn't it? What a good idea.
Great, some great bits.
Yeah.
I'll be reading that.
Well, I went online and Googled independent publishers and lots of things came up. And when I read some of them, I found more than one. In fact, several would say, we read every manuscript. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean they read it all the way through.
Right.
But they will give it a chance, which I think is very unusual because the large houses just don't do that.
Yeah. Well, the large houses will only take agent submissions.
Yeah.
And you will find agents saying, we read every submission, we consider every submission.
Right, right. If you want to publish and if you don't have an agent for the smaller presses.
Oh yeah.
Then you can really. That's a door that needs to be explored, I think.
Yeah.
Well, Writers and Artists Yearbook have a whole section on independent publishers, and Mislexia publish a book every year on British indie publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to some of the festivals, the indie publishers are very often at the festivals looking to network with people and meet people. So, as Teresa said, they may be genre-specific, so you need to go and find find the ones.
Yeah.
I mean, I found one when I was looking at this that I can't remember the name, so if you're listening and you know who this is, they only publish crime novels that are written from the point of view of the villain.
Oh.
And I thought, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah. Different, but very, very, very specific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Stephanie and I were really delighted to get the opportunity to talk to Kate McDonald a few weeks ago from Handheld Press. Let's hear that interview.
We're delighted to welcome Kate McDonald, author, editor, literary historian, academic, and founder of Handheld Press. Welcome, Kate, and thanks for talking to us.
No, happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about how you came to start Handheld Press.
Okay, well, when I was doing my PhD back in the late 80s, I was also moving into editing, and the first job I got wasn't as an editor. I didn't go into academia straight away. So I worked as a technical editor at English Heritage in archaeology, even though my PhD was in English literature. And that carried on, got married, had babies, went freelance, moved countries. When the children were old enough, I decided I'd had enough of editing other people's work and went back to postdoc research. So I reinvented myself as an academic. And I still maintain the editing angle in that I went into research to do with publishing history and taught publishing as well as English literature and cultural studies. And I ended up editing a lot as an academic, because when you're an academic, you become the editor of collections of essays or a series. And I did all that. And it just turned out I was doing way more editing as an academic than I was actually doing of my own writing. And then in March 2017, I had come back. I'd been living abroad as well. I lived in Belgium for 18 years. So when I wanted to come back to Britain, mainly because of my research, which is all Britain-focused, I could not get a job in academia in Britain. But I had a visiting fellowship at Reading, which has got the best publishing archive in the UK for researching publishing history. So I was very happy at Reading as a visiting fellow, and I got a short-term contract, but no permanent jobs because I'm the wrong age, I've got a very non-standard career path, I don't fit the usual pattern. And this was getting very frustrating. And I was still setting up publishing projects. I was running a series with Routledge. I had just beginning to set up a new one with Palgrave. And one of my research colleagues said, Kate, you need to set up your own publishing company. And I went, nah. And that was on a Friday. And on the Monday, I had registered the domain name. My husband and I had sorted out the finance. And it was all go from there. And wow. I never look back. I've never been happier.
Brilliant, brilliant. So how long has that been going? When did that happen?
Well, that was March 2017. The company was incorporated in June, and we published our first books October 2017. So we've only been going a little bit over a year, and we have published 9 books, 4 more contracted, and I'm pursuing about 5 others, which are in different states of maybe happening or maybe not.
So there are 3 brands to Handheld Press. There's the classic, the research, and the modern. Can you talk about those?
Well, the classics and the research is what I really wanted to do. Classics is reprints. So if you think of Virago Press, Persephone Books, all those really big, very influential reprint houses, they reprint texts that have been fallen out of print for one reason or another that deserve to be brought back. And that's what I really wanted to do. And all my research has been about discovering fabulous stories and amazing authors from the early 20th century and bringing them back to scholarly attention. And I wanted to bypass the scholarly thing and bring them back to regular readers who just want to read a book for pleasure. So that's what the classics were based on. But they have evolved into a much more woman-focused and maybe even the science fiction-y list. The first book is science fiction. It's Edwardian science fiction, What Might Have Been by Ernest Brummer. So I've always had that interest. But more and more I've been finding it's the women's books that need to be brought out more, because the men's books, I don't know, are either the ones that are still forgotten. There's perhaps a good reason why they're still forgotten. Whereas the women's books, there's some very good stuff out there that really needs to be brought back. The research line is because I do have a strong feeling that scholarly research, which is publicly funded, needs to be made available to the public in accessible ways. And academics, because of the nature of the job, have to write in a certain way, which is really not accessible. Mm-hmm. Some are a lot more accessible than others, but most academics have to write in a very inaccessible, technical, jargony way. Mm-hmm. And I want to bypass that. I want to extract the stories that come out of the research and present them as books for the regular public. And so far we've done 2. One is a study, well, it's a collection of letters between a conscientious objector and his wife, First World War, which I edited, but it was a family archive I was introduced to. And the other was, originally, it was a self-published book by an American whose godmother, or faux godmother, had been the lover of a British poet and had been part of the Sylvia Townsend Warner Valentine Ackland sort of love triangle. And this story had been known about, but nobody ever knew about Elizabeth Wade White's side of the story, the American side of the story. So he published it as a pretty good book, but it needed editing. And I reviewed it. This is about 6 years ago. And I said, why has nobody picked this up? This is the literary love story of the year. And then when I did set up Handheld, that book was still available. He said it had sold 30 copies on Amazon.
Wow.
So I bought the rights from him and I edited it and we sorted out the pictures and we just gave it a better design and it's done rather well. It's important for women's history, it's important for literary history, for lesbian history, all sorts of intersecting readers. So those two are the only two research titles I've had. I've been looking at a few others, but nothing so far has come through.
Well, you mentioned the conscientious objector's wife, the letters between Frank and Lucy Sunderland. So how did those letters come to your attention?
Well, I'm a Quaker. And when I was at Reading, I was still living in Brussels, but I worked at Reading. So I went to stay in Reading 3 or 4 days a month to get my research done and see people, have meetings, teach a class. And I stayed with Quaker friends who were in Reading. And we became friends as well, not just Quaker connections. And then one evening they said, because they had learned a lot about my research by then, which was First World War, they would you like to see the family letters between Elizabeth's grandfather and her grandmother? Because he was a CEO. And I said, good Lord, you mean there's a family archive no one's ever seen? Wow. Well, yes. So I read them and it was about 200,000 words of letters, which is a hell of a lot. Mm-hmm. And I realized this is a book, but it's got to be edited. Mm-hmm. So what's my story? So with the family's eager permission, I decided it was going to be about the wife. It wasn't about the conscientious objector himself. It's about the wife's story, because this story is never told. It's domestic life in the First World War on the home front in a community which is very pro-pacifist, but it's still not easy. And what it's like bringing up three children as the only breadwinner when your husband's in prison. You're not getting the army salary as soldiers' wives were. You've still got to manage. And there was a narrative. So I pulled out the golden thread of narrative and presented it as a story. And that, too, has done rather well, which is very pleasing.
But how do you choose your classic books?
I've got a wish list. I've got a running list on Excel, and they were at the top. But even if I want a book, it may not be available. So first I have to read it again.
Mm-hmm.
It's all very well relying on my memories of when I last read it. I have to reread it and think, will this sell? Does this hold up? Is it worth reprinting? Because some books are pleasant, but honestly, there's not actually any other reason other than they're pleasant. It's got to be, I have to feel passionate about a book before I can sell it. And I am the only one doing the marketing. I have freelancers doing bits. I've got a freelance publicity person. I pay sales representatives by commission to sell my books. There's an agency that do this who are pretty good. But I am the one writing the marketing copy. I'm the one persuading people. I'm the one talking to people like you, saying this is why. So if a book doesn't do that to me, I can't take it on. So if I'm enthusiastic about a book, then are the rights available? If the author is out of copyright, that's really good. I don't have to pay royalties. If the text is in copyright, that is, if it's under 70 years since the author died, then I have to find the estate. If I can find the estate, I have to communicate with them and say, I'd like to do this. If the estate are willing and want to talk to me, then we can probably reach a deal, but maybe not. And only then will I have the book. So you see, there are many stages to get through.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still stuck towards the end of the stage with 5 books because of the talking to agents, especially if they want to hang out for a better deal or they don't think Handheld is good enough.
Mm.
That's difficult.
Yeah. What occurred to me when you were talking about the conscientious objector's wife and you said, you know, that the story, the wife or the family story hadn't been told. And is that so when you're looking at classic fiction, is that something that you're looking for, something, you know, a story that a social aspect that hasn't been told or been forgotten?
Yes, I am looking for stories that haven't been told before. I'm also looking for stories with edge. Some reprint houses, and I'm not going to name names because that's just not fair, they will publish books because they have a particular reader in mind or a particular product in mind, and I just find that not the way I would like to publish. Mm. My particular taste is for stories with edge, which is why I like science fiction. I like stories that make you think, stories that poke you and force you to reassess things, but they have to be amazing stories. You have to want to finish reading them. They might be a little bit uncomfortable, but they will have wow factor. They will be stories of wonder in whatever way. So those are the criteria, I think, that I go on. They have to really excite me.
I'd like to talk about handheld modern.
Oh, good. Yes, handheld. I'd forgotten that. Handheld modern. That wasn't an afterthought, but it kind of snuck up on me because I also knew, as well as publishing reprinted fiction, I wanted to publish new fiction, but I wasn't sure of what. And initially, I wanted to publish science fiction by women because I have a big interest in science fiction, as you can probably tell. But as it happened, the first handheld modern was a translation of a Danish thriller, which was presented to me out of the blue. I advertised in the Quaker magazine, The Friend, saying, hello, we're here, just to see what would happen. And I got this book, which is fantastic. It's by a first-time translator who was a linguist. And he learned Danish because his daughter married a Dane and he wanted to be able to chat to the grandchildren in their second language. And he did this by translating. And the thriller is fantastic. Originally, it was called Onskebarnet in Danish, but now it's After the Death of Ellen Kjellberg. And it's a story of a murder that happened in Skane. Skane is a very small seaside resort and artist town in the very far north of Denmark. It's tiny. I happen to have been there because I have friends who live there. So that was a help. So I knew the environment. But it's set in winter when all the tourists have gone. And it's about the fishing. It's about how local people get their pizzas and what they do for fun. And I was just blown away. So we published that. I've entered it for a couple of prizes and we'll see. It's a slow burn, I think. I think it's a word of mouth. Sales are happening every week, but not many. Mm-hmm. And the other one is So Lucky by Nicola Griffiths. This one dropped into my lap like a ripe pear because I know Nicola because I've been following her career since the 90s when she began publishing initially science fiction, most recently historical fiction. She wrote the novel Hild about Hilda of Whitby, which was an absolute smash 2 years ago. And I had been assisting her with the research for that, finding her academic articles from archaeology and so on that she couldn't get at. And then when she was doing a PhD at Anglia Ruskin University, I helped her as a friendly academic. I gave her a mock viva. So I took her through the kind of questioning you get when you are being grilled. And she hasn't got an academic background. So we are friends. And then she said, oh, I'm doing this novella. I'm supposed to be writing the sequel to Hild, but I've just dropped out of it because I can't not write this story. What do you think? And I, along with other people, read it and said, well, this and that, and yes, it's wonderful, but Disney's changing. And then it got published. And as she was approaching US publication in May this year, because she lives in America, she said, I want you to publish the UK edition. And I went, oh, okay, right, that's out of the blue. Have I got room for it? And that was my first concern. Obviously, I wanted it because it was amazing. But I needed to know, how can I fit this into my schedule, which was already quite packed? Because if you've got a book coming out, you need a good month before and after to focus on marketing, all the administration, all the publicity. It has to be managed and you need time. And so I squeezed it in. So just before So Lucky was going to come out, the biggest hit of our publishing career so far happened, which was the reprint of Sylvia Townsend Warner Kingdoms of Elfin, which just went berserk. I've had so many good sales from that. So the marketing for that didn't need as much attention. It was kind of doing its own thing. So I had the time as it happened to focus on So Lucky. So that was the Kingdoms of Elfin was at the end of October. So Lucky was 3 weeks later. That's not enough time. Never will I do that again. But as it happened, I was fortunate that So Kingdoms could look after itself.
But how many books a year are you planning to publish?
imprint, this is what I tell the bank six. Because they like to know roughly what throughput of cash they can expect. But as I say, I published two in 2017 and seven in 2018 because Nicola crept up on me. Mm. I want to stick to six. I think six is realistic. And that also gives me the margin for another explosion like Nicola's, maybe.
Yeah.
So let's try for six.
Okay, so our listeners will be wanting to know what kind of books are you looking for in handheld modern next year?
Something that I will really like, and that's so not helpful, I know. I do not, maybe easier, I do not want novels about a pet who leaves home to find a new life. I've had that recently pitched to me. That's not what I'm interested in. I quite like animals, but I'm not a pet person. I definitely don't want anything that is self-described as contemporary romance, which involves a couple having problems in their relationship. I'm mm-hmm. really not interested in that. I don't do children's fiction or YA. These are very specific markets. I don't have the expertise. I don't know that field, so I don't do that. Any text that involves murder, violence, or torture, not interested. If it has to be murder for the needs of the plot, I'm really not interested if it involves objectification or victimization of minority groups of any kind. Yeah, tricky one, isn't it? Mm. What have I got left? I've been nurturing several fantastic novels, but two of them have just fallen by the wayside. The first one was historical. I'm definitely open to historical fiction. But the author wanted to take the novel, which I thought was pretty good as it stood, just needed a bit of tweaking and a bit of tightening. He just wanted to make it a trilogy with a whole set of extra backstories, and he wasn't interested in making the first one good.
Right.
And I thought, okay, well, I have to leave you there. You carry on, and you do what you feel you must, but I can't go with you. The second one was an amazing alternative history steampunky novel, which I thought was tremendous because the author's grasp of language was superb. And I am extremely picky because I've got an academic background. I am so picky about anachronism, historicization, making the reader believe that you are in the alternative past through the use of language and not making stupid mistakes about historical wrongness. And he had all that absolutely perfect, but he couldn't get the plot right. The plot just wandered off in very strange directions. So we've shelved that, and he sent me an earlier novel. And I have high hopes of this second novel he sent me because it's his first one. Very often the first novel explodes and really you really have the sense of what that writer is all about. But I trust the quality of his writing. And there is a third one I'm nurturing, which we're still in discussion. I'm waiting for the third draft. This particular writer, he entered a novella for a competition that I was part of a book blogging collective called Vulpus Libris. We didn't judge this, but we were invited to review all the novellas in the competition. So we did. And I absolutely loved his novella. I thought he was an amazing writer. So he stayed in touch with me. And then when he realized that Handheld had happened, he wrote saying, would you like to read my extension of that novella? And I said, yes, absolutely. So we to and fro'd, and he's now writing the third version. And I really have very high hopes. The quality of his writing and his storytelling are very high, so I've got great hopes. But these are men. This is what annoys me. The three novels that work best for me are by men. And I have had many novels from women, but they're either boring or bad or actually just not what I'm interested in.
Right.
So that's really annoying for me. I want to nurture everybody's writing.
Yeah.
So far, I've got three white men. It really helps if people want to submit to look at the Handheld website, because there are different pages, but there's a form to fill in for the classics, for the research, and for modern. Because it's very important when you submit a novel to explain what it is, what the context is, and who's going to buy it. I'm not asking you to do the marketing for me, but I need to know who you think you're writing for. Yeah. And the forum helps you express this and articulate what I need to know. Let me tell you what happened to me with this Guardian article. The novel in question was What Not, which is Rose Macaulay, 1918. I discovered this novel because 6 years ago, seven years ago, I began a project to bring Rose Macaulay back into academic interest. And it took a long time and a lot of, there's a conference, there was talking to publishers, but we got a book of collected essays out, scholarly essays about Rose Macaulay. First time this has happened. In the course of that, I read everything she'd written, and I did a massive bibliography of all her published journalism and all her books and all the critical work on her. So I am the expert on Rose Macaulay at the moment. So I knew there was this book, What Not, and very few people had read it because it was brought out and then very quickly withdrawn because two pages were very libelous. And the directors of the company, Constable, were very worried about being taken to court by people like Lord Northcliffe and Lord Beaverbrook, the Rupert Murdochs of their day. So the book was reissued with two or three anodyne pages covering the gap in the plates. Because in the old way of printing, if you withdrew a book, you had to replace the offending text with exactly the same length of type. The
physical page.
Exactly, yeah. And then the book flopped because the impetus had gone. So the book kind of disappeared, and then she brought out another novel and it all carried on. And I thought, this is crazy. This book has to be revised. And I knew that text had been taken out, but nobody knew what the missing text was, what the offending pages were, because nobody has a copy of the first edition. Even the British Library doesn't.
Wow.
Because it was withdrawn so quickly, they never got the first edition. I have a friend called John Clute, who is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction. He is a guru for science fiction history. And he said casually, oh, I've got that. No, you don't. Yes, I do. And he showed me, and blow me, he had the copy, wow, of the director's copy with the penciled excisions. He's an amazing man. So I photographed the pages and then I built my new edition. So I had the edition ready. The text was still being assembled. I had the introduction, I had the prelims, I had the proofread text, I was working out the notes. I sent out my early publicity to the bookseller, because in book publishing you have to send publicity really well in advance. So for a book that's coming out in March, they needed to know by early November so they could work out for their preview pages. The journalist in charge of reprint fiction, who had already been very excited about the Sylvia Townsend Warner book that I'd reprinted, she said, Kate, I need to see this book. Send me the PDF as soon as you can. Okay, I will. So next Monday, she was nagging me again. Kate, where's the PDF? Oh my God, here it is. We've just finished it. Next thing I know, she's writing an article for The Guardian, which really, really took me by surprise. So I sent her photographs. I did a bit more to and fro with her about the details. The Guardian article appeared on Monday, 10th of December. I didn't know when it would happen. And I went to the gym on Monday morning, emerged, looked at my phone, and I had about 15 pre-orders already. And I thought, right. So by the end of Monday, I'd sold over 60 pre-orders, which is completely unheard of in one day. Just extraordinary. I think it's because the book is, A, it's a fairly well-known novelist. It's an unknown novel, so that's exciting. Yeah. It's a centenary. That's also good for the hook. But it's the Brave New World connection. The fact that this novel is quite clearly one of the influences for Brave New World. Mm-hmm. That has made the big effect.
Wow.
I've learned so much in a very short time about strategy, about rights, about capitalizing, maximizing what I do have, piggybacking on the back of this interest, because suddenly handheld is in the news in a small way, and I could use that. So that's why it's been a bit busy. Mm. And I've sold a lot of books.
Good for you. Yeah, that's great.
As you say, that's a wonderful story in itself.
It is, yeah. Well, if people want to send me books, you know where I am.
Okay, yeah. Brilliant. We'll make sure they know. We'll put a link on the Facebook group.
Yeah, do.
That's been brilliant talking to you, Kate. Thanks very much for
fascinating.
That. Such a lot to think about there.
Yeah.
No, thank you. Thank you for asking. It's been good to do it.
Well, that was absolutely brilliant. And Zelda Fitzgerald's Save the Waltz has already been published, and Rose Macaulay's Whatnot will follow soon.
Can't wait for that one.
Yeah,
wait for that one.
I think we're all excited about that one.
Yeah, very excited.
The precursor to Brave New World.
Because it was, as you'll have heard in the interview, it was published and then withdrawn very quickly.
That's an amazing story as well. Yeah. That's an unbelievable story about how the...
There's a book about that.
Well, yes, there probably is. Well, it's nearly time to wrap up for this week, but before we do, there's just time for Pat and Craig Smith to tell us what's on their bedside tables.
Well, I've gone to another of our favourites, not just my favourites, back to Kate Atkinson.
Oh,
I've just nearly finished Transcription, and I think we've talked about Life After Life and A God in Ruins in the sort of
I've read both of those.
Both of which have sort of mined the Second World War for material and have deployed that sort of time shift thing. And Transcription does the same, but to a much lesser extent. It tells the story of an 18-year-old called Juliet Armstrong, who in 1940 is recruited into the world of espionage. And she's sent to an obscure department of MI5, where she's tasked with monitoring the comings and goings of the British fascist sympathisers.
Ooh.
So there's lots of her...
The Mitford girls.
So there's lots of her sort of sitting in a room, listening in through various speaker devices to this group of people. But it's quite funny because there are bits that get muffled and then somebody's coughing or there's...
Oh, that sounds terribly funny.
Terribly unprofessional. Or a dog barking or something like that. And so, yeah. And sometimes she's making up what she thinks it might have been and sometimes she's just...
Yeah.
But 10 years later, so it switches then, 10 years later, she's working as a producer at the BBC. And the pictures that are drawn of that work and the characters involved there, it's quite entertaining. I'm not sure the BBC would be entirely happy with it. But figures from her past reappear. So the story switches from present to past and vice versa, all the while creating the mystery that's at the heart of it, because it is. And you're constantly thinking, well, what the hell is going on here? And the book's full of quirky but very believable characters. And the writing is just quite typical, really, of Atkinson's dryly humorous style. It's a good read.
Oh, sounds brilliant.
Yeah, it's a good read.
Okay, let's hear from Craig Smith.
Currently, I am reading The History of New Zealand by Michael King. It's quite a very big, thick book and contains lots and lots of very concise. He's an amazing writer. He's passed away now, Michael King, but he's an amazing author, being able to put some very technical and normally quite boring subjects into a very layman's term that most people can understand. And I'm really enjoying this book.
Well, I have to confess, I know absolutely nothing about the history of New Zealand, so maybe I better read that one too. Sadly, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. Thanks for listening, especially in Botswana, but all of you. Don't forget to subscribe on Radio Public, iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Please take a few minutes to leave us a review or drop by our Facebook group and introduce yourself. Our family's growing all the time, so please introduce a friend to Write Club the podcast. Goodbye!
Bye! Bye.